Up next from the Stanford Center for Social Innovation, Thomas Gibeon discusses his experiences developing a private equity business focused on Africa and how it has changed over the years. Gibeon is the chairman and co-founder of Emerging Capital Partners. On Social Innovation Conversations.
Hi, I'm Chris Deigelmeyer, the Executive Director of the Center for Social Innovation.
And I'm Eric Nee, the Managing Editor of the Stanford Social Innovation Review.
Welcome to Social Innovation Conversations. Today, we're excited to bring you another presentation in the Stanford Discussion Series.
This podcast is brought to you by the Center for Social Innovation, a department of the Stanford Graduate School of Business that educates leaders to solve the world's toughest social and environmental problems. To be the first to learn about our latest published conversation and for more social innovation ideas, follow us at SOC Innovators on Twitter.
And now, here is our presentation.
Hello, everyone. We've come to the, close of our conference. Thank you all for coming. Thanks to all the distinguished guests and panelists. We've had fun today. It's been very informative. It's been very interesting. At this point, I'd like to introduce our EndNote speaker in the person of Thomas Gibeon. Tom is the chairman of ECP. ECP is Emerging Capital Partners. It is the first private equity firm to raise more than $1 billion to invest in companies in Africa, and they have several funds doing this. Mr. Gibeon has served on several boards, and he's currently a trustee of the Center for Global Development. Mr. Gibeon received his bachelor's degree in honors from Worcester in Ohio, and he also got an MBA from Wharton. So if you could just round of applause, sort of bring up Mr. Gibeon.
And thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here today at the Stanford Africa Forum. It's an honor to have shared the stage with Tom Berry and Richard Essex and others that I've known for some time, and of course with others on today's panels and in the audience that represent the really incredible people doing important work, making a difference in people's lives in Africa. I've found, and I can attest, that the community of people who care deeply about Africa is the warmest, most embracing community in the world. I thought I would begin by offering a few reflections on what it has been like to develop a private equity business focused on Africa and how things have changed over the years. My story begins in 1999. I began with my previous firm, Emerging Markets Partnership. When we looked around the world and noticed that they had set up fund management companies in all of the emerging markets, Asia, Latin America, Eastern Europe, but there was a big blank spot on the map, which was Africa. From a personal perspective, I've been to Africa a few times. I visited relatives there in Kenya and in Malawi. I knew the place well enough to know that nobody understood Africa, particularly Americans. We just didn't get it. So when the EMP guys asked me if I'd consider leaving the Asia business, where I had been a managing director, to start the Africa business with no promise that we would be able to raise the money or invest it, with no lifeline back to Asia should it not work out, and with no example of anyone having been successful before, I did not hesitate. I absolutely wanted to do this. I wanted to run something. I wanted to look people in the eye and say that we were going to underpromise and overdeliver, and that we would always put their interests first. More than that, I didn't have a clue. As far as nobody ever succeeding before in African private equity, South Africa was an exception. South Africa's difficult history had produced a sense of financial and technological self-reliance, born out of a concern that the rest of the world had an uneasy and uncertain trading and commercial relationship with them as an apartheid state. So as a number of multinational businesses departed South Africa for one reason or another, the core skill set essential to successful private equity, that is simply, what's it worth How do you value something? A dozen years ago, that core skill set developed in South Africa, but outside of South Africa, the rest of Africa was pre-frontier. For most of my friends, Africa made Cambodia look interesting. Now, here I'll pause and say that the best entrepreneurs are lousy historians. Or maybe they're just unconventional thinkers. My experience with entrepreneurs is that they have the ability to gain a little altitude and see the world from a particular vantage point that is not overly influenced by what's happened in the last 10 or 15 years, let alone the last 10 or 15 minutes. To be an entrepreneur means that you're entirely comfortable acting as if the future will not be the same as the present. Entrepreneurs see time as a continuum. It moves in a way that sometimes can be predictable. It's just that most people aren't paying attention. To be an entrepreneur means that you trust trends. You understand that to be successful, you don't wait for governance to be perfect. You don't wait for perfect transparency. You wait for improvement. And when you have improvement, you jump. I'd like to put some perspective on the Africa story. Back when the earth was cooling and dinosaurs roamed the earth, no, actually slightly after that, because I'm thinking of the early 1990s, when I found myself living in Hong Kong, co-managing Goldman Sachs' project and structured finance group. The other guy running the group, he might have been a Stanford guy when I think about it, the other guy running the group had gotten there a couple of months before I'd gotten there. And I remember him saying, let's divide Asia between the two of us. I'll take Malaysia, the Philippines, Thailand. You take South Korea and China. Now, I knew that I had just drawn the short stick, but I wasn't sure why. So I started making trips up to China. Back then, it was known as mainland China or big China. You don't hear that so much anymore. This is 20 years ago. There was no private property in China. There were no land titles. There were no courthouses. There were no lawyers to opine whether the title you had was filed correctly in the courthouse, because there was none of that infrastructure. There was no legal infrastructure associated with being able to buy and sell property. China was also very short of power. And it was this lack of electricity that everyone had predicted would be the chokehold on China's economic growth. Sound familiar? You don't hear that anymore about China. Now, we had this idea that we could monetize certain existing power plants. We'd buy an old one, enter into a power purchase agreement, sell back the power, and the province or the municipality or the state could use the proceeds of the sale to build a new power plant. That's when I learned that you can't buy something if you don't know who owns it, and that communist China really had been communist. When we went around looking at power plants to buy, it was quite an experience. We looked at one built by the Japanese during the 1930s occupation in Qingdao, still working, and we looked at some more recent ones. Remember, this is a time when Shanghai was still poor. It still had old buildings, didn't have a metro. When I say poor, I mean it had no money. Nobody had money. This was back when you traveled there, you had to buy your own money. There was money only for you, for tourists, for visitors. They had a separate currency for visitors. So we were looking at these factories, and we realized how they were building factories during this time. It was all dependent on the guy who happened to be the plant manager, and he would call up various factories. Somebody who made the generator, somebody who made the turbine, somebody who made the cables, somebody who made the transmission lines. And they'd place an order, and over a period of months or years, a train would come by, the door would open, they'd dump this stuff out on the site, and you'd see these engineers walking around deciding which of the pieces of the electric components that happened to be like dumped in the mud could they pull out of the mud and actually make into a power plant. Complaining was not allowed. You were glad to get whatever you could get a hold of. The specifications were just work with it. Now, all this has changed. When is the last time you've heard somebody say that electricity is what's going to stop the economic miracle of China? Now, my dad is Czech. I've been to Prague since I was 10 years old. Back in the day, behind the Iron Curtain, the nicest retail spaces in Old Town sold plumbing supplies and bags of cement. People ratted each other out. The authorities lied about everything, including the weather. The Czech Republic is not perfect, but it is an example of people being more resilient than we might have expected, more adaptable, quick to pick things up. Even 10 years ago in India, you couldn't buy a Coca-Cola, you couldn't open a McDonald's. 50 years or so of state socialism had brought the place to near ruin. Before the millennium, 1998, 1999, if you landed at the Bombay airport, you would drive in. All of the billboards were Bharti, industrial fixtures. There was no consumer dynamic at all, no consumer kind of attitude. And then something happened. They got really lucky. They just got a lucky break. Y2K. Americans began to worry in 1998, that on January 1st, 2000, the traffic lights would go down. That on January 1st, you'd go into the bathroom you couldn't fill up your bathtub. So everybody filled their bathtubs up the night before just in case. There was a sense of corporate panic as to what was going to happen. In India, with its English-speaking engineers and entrepreneurs, and finally, government recognition that it could not plan or regulate its way out of abject poverty, loosened things up and allowed privately owned companies to go after international contracts. No longer would India be a Raj economy. And the rest, as they say, is history. Now, these global events were not unrelated or in any sense isolated. The knock-off effect of things working moves around the globe at varying speeds. The more monolithic your system of governance, the faster innovation happens. So China was pretty fast. India, less so. Africa, with 53 countries, will be even slower. But that's okay, because there are 53 diverse countries, and that also prevents things from unwinding all at once. There's a certain frustration with the pace of change, but a certain stability that the changes across the continent rest on so many different civic, policy, academic, and political leaders. In this way, Africa resembles a very noisy democracy. Now, the demonstration effect of success is powerful. I just talked about China, I just talked about India, I just talked about the Czech Republic. Just as the demonstration effect of failure is equally revealing. No one looks to Zimbabwe's corrupt, power-hungry, and cynical form of government as one to emulate. And in many ways, it has remained a self-contained, one-off example of what not to do. Meanwhile, governments that are opening up their phone companies, media companies, logistics, education, power, and healthcare to market forces are creating the demonstration effects that are being replicated. Just look at banking reform measures, insurance penetration rates, and the use of mobile phones for point-of-sale transactions. This is the pattern of reform. It's creeping across neighboring countries. To me, it appears relentless. Has it become a disruptive technology? I think we all have to be a little bit more impatient. I think that the part of the equation that we have yet to completely put together is one of just being damned impatient with the pace of change. It's happening, and it will be disruptive, and it'll be good. The point is that the improvements in the economic well-being of billions of Chinese and Indians are not the result of simple good luck or a trip to the casino or lining up important decisions so that they are made on an astrologically auspicious date on the calendar. The Chinese and the Indians, just like the Taiwanese and the Malaysians before them, decided to allow the private sector to be the engine of growth. This is hard work, and it does not take centuries or decades for the benefits to be felt. And you may, in fact, begin to see even more real change in Africa over the next couple of years because of the work that has already begun. Now, if I sound optimistic, it's not because I think political leaders are necessarily becoming enlightened or practicing yoga. The private sector is more effective at creating jobs and wealth and efficiently attracting and allocating capital. Political leaders are actually well served by letting go, by getting out of the way, by redefining their mission. The suggestion here is that it's the rational, coherent thing in 2011 for political leaders, including those who desperately want to cling to power, to allow their private sectors to be the engine of growth. And I think that that's what we're seeing across Africa. Of course, that's not the whole story. As Africa nears 1 billion people, fiber optics encircle it. Its natural resources increase in value even in the ground. Its varied cultures focused on the family, consensus building, and respect for all members of the community no longer seems quaint or out of place, but rather suggests a way forward that makes more sense than ever to those who see Africa as having enormous potential, resiliency, and promise. Of course, that's not the whole story. For instance, and everyone has a little variation on this, but the current state of the African power sector is illustrative of the tremendous investment gap which has acted as a chokehold on growth across the continent. The power generation capacity of the 48 countries that comprise sub-Sahara Africa, which together are populated by 800 million people, is roughly the same as Spain, with its 45 million people. The entrepreneurs here today, you know who you are not overwhelmed by negative statistics when assessing Africa's future. We see the opportunities that occur when the volatile mix of capital, technology, and entrepreneurism combine, always to form something new. Rarely will it look like something that comes from a government's planning commission, or will it be part of a bureaucrat's plan with some distant year in the title. The firm I started 11 years ago has grown and is in some ways a good example of entrepreneurism in Africa. I realize that the biggest threat to an army is from its own generals who want to fight the last war and not the next war. So I'm not suggesting that our lessons learned should be applied uncritically. We took the approach that we should open the aperture as wide as possible. Why fight with one arm tied behind your back? So we defined Africa to mean all of Africa, from Cairo to Cape Town. We defined our eligible businesses as being everything that wasn't something. So no guns, no gaming, no hard liquor. But if you couldn't, you know, if it wasn't on the list, you could do it. We can take control positions, and we can take minority positions with influence. We can work in Francophone Africa, Anglophone Africa, and Arab-speaking Africa. We are on the ground, and we are big, at least by Africa standards. It turns out that being big is practically the best thing you can be if you want to be sustainable. We're not specialists, we're generalists. We also learned that the value creation proposition in Africa is not driven by quarterly profits. And to make it so destroys trust and suggests that you don't know what you're doing, that you don't really get Africa. Africa is full of very good businesses that have near monopolies because they've been established with strong brand names, because capital is scarce, particularly when you're trying to raise it to take on a strong incumbent. Good businesses give back to their communities, and in fact, that's an important element of being able to keep a tight hold on your franchise in Africa. In Africa, good businesses partner with host communities, with their labor forces, with their suppliers, and with their providers of capital. Of course, the shareholders, the owners of the business, are central to the value proposition. But this is not a sprint. Real money is made over a long period of time, which is less likely to happen if you put a quarter's financial performance ahead of building the kind of trust which eventually fosters near monopolistic business advantages. All of us know that the telecom story in Africa has been a good one. We heard about it some today. When we started our business in Africa, I'll give you the way I tell the story, Africa had about the same number of phones as metropolitan Washington, D.C., but most of them didn't work. I was there, but looking back at those times, 10, 12 years ago, is like hearing stories from the youth of your parents. People rode horses. Women didn't vote. The phones didn't even work in the hotels for room service. Motorola thought that the way to give people dial tone was by selling $4,000 satellite phones at $10 a minute. Now Africa is telecom's fastest growing market. There are more people with mobile dial tone than there are in Africa than there are people in the United States of America. And there's no sign of it slowing down. I'd like to now, this is sort of a little bit on my business. I now want lessons about business. I'm going to give you a lesson on life, at least what I've learned. I always wonder why people don't talk about that more, what they've learned about life. I'd like to make a comment on governance, integrity, transparency, and fair play. We would rather do business with a smart, honest guy who shares our values, even if he's working in a very difficult place, than to do a deal with a shady guy working in a pristine environment. People ask me what countries I like in Africa. I don't like any countries in Africa. Or maybe I like them all. What I really care about are the people I'm doing business with. And in this regard, I treat them all the same as I do my kids, including my high school senior at home. Trust but verify. I happen to be a Quaker. Yes, I'm a pacifist. My hero is Martin Luther King. I'm astonished that nonviolent conflict resolution is not the first thing that we as a society and as a leading nation of the world tries. I'm making the point because for me, personal integrity is my most important asset. I want you to know that. And I tell people when I meet them in business, right up front, I will not lie and I will not cheat. Right up front. So they remember you said it. And then throughout the relationship, you will never ask of them something that you would not ask of yourself. I don't know if that's the right thing to do or not, but I put it out there just so that there can be no mistake. And then, of course, you can't make an exception just because it's convenient or even because no one will notice. I'm making a big deal about this because too many people will not do business in Africa because they think there will be corruption or that they won't be able to trust people. I can tell you that most people in Africa that we do business with are as concerned about their reputations as I am about mine. So let's not be embarrassed to talk about stuff like this. What I'm urging is that the best and the brightest of the community of people who care deeply about Africa consider the enormous potential of the place and our individual and collective roles to rebrand Africa as the destination for sustainable investments made with patient capital by men and women who place their personal integrity ahead of financial gain. I don't claim to be able to articulate the exact manner in which we can stimulate job creation or technological innovation. We will have to invent a new vocabulary, or maybe not. Perhaps we need to recognize and be willing to use the words we already know. Words we know to be sufficient, should we choose to live by them. Because when you do, they will resonate, and good people will trust you, and the gap between Africa and the BRICS that appears so significant today will, within a period of time that matters to you, disappear.
You've been listening to a presentation from the Stanford Discussion Series.
This podcast is brought to you by the Center for Social Innovation, a department of the Stanford Graduate School of Business that educates leaders to solve the world's toughest social and environmental problems. To be the first to learn about our latest published conversation and for more social innovation ideas, follow us at SOC Innovators on Twitter.
The post-production audio engineer for this program was John Van Horn. Our website editor was Marguerite Rigoglioso. The series producer is Bernadette Clavier.
This is Chris Steigelmeier.
And Eric Nie on Social Innovation Conversations.
Thank you for listening.